Do the recent revelations by NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden about widespread state monitoring of American and British electronic communications signal the arrival of the dystopian future George Orwell warned us about? What are the capabilities of those surveillance technologies? What are the historical origins of the surveillance state? What factors have influenced domestic spying in Canada? And how responsibly has mainstream media been covering the Snowden leaks and their implications? This week, we'll be hearing perspectives from three observers: San Francisco-based writer and researcher Tom Burkhart, Ottawa-based activist and writer Stephen Gowans, and global research journalist and editor Julie Levesque. On today's program, Edward Snowden and the emerging police state. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of July 18th, 2013. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also now be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. I went online and read about Michael Hastings, the guy who brought down General McChrystal. The conspiracy theories were already being spun on the web, that a bomb had been planted in the car or that its controls had been hacked and the crash was engineered remotely by an unseen hand. For nearly 5 years, McChrystal served as chief of the Joint Special Operations Command, which oversees the military's commando units, including the Army Delta Force and the Navy SEALs. A reporter brings him down and then dies in a mysterious crash 3 years later. If this had happened in Russia, wouldn't we all figure it was some dark military conspiracy? That's from Death of Rolling Stone Muckraker, The Michael Hastings Wreck, Video Evidence Only Deepens the Mystery, by Michael Krikorian, posted July 17th, 2013, originally appearing in Who, What, Why. If I had met the quota, every 2 weeks I would have made 1,250 gourds. I needed to support my family and I couldn't survive. When I left the factory, I was so angry that when I passed the woman who'd cooked the food I had bought for lunch, I just gave her all the money and went on my way. Me, if I had a message I could send to the higher-ups, there will always be factories because they've always existed, crushing the poor. But Mrs. Bill Clinton will never see me working there. That's from A Haitian Sweatshop Worker Speaks. Mrs. Clinton can have her factories. This was a transcription of an interview by Beverly Bell with Marjorie Vancela, a former Haitian assembly worker on an embroidery machine, posted July 15th, originally posted at otherworldsarepossible.org. As thousands of South Africans hold prayer sessions outside his Pretoria hospital, and with the world media still on an escalating death watch, inside there's been a clash among and between family members, government officials trying to control and spin health information, and even doctors who have been cited wrongly in court battles about his condition. There had been an official denial of a claim that he is in a vegetative state, along with unsubstantiated rumors that he is being kept alive at least until July 18th, his 95th birthday, a day marked worldwide as Mandela Day, to encourage community service. Meanwhile, a sideshow sparked by warring family members robs the occasion of any of the dignity it deserves, with one daughter of an earlier marriage and her daughter lashing out in an obvious bid for money and even to control media coverage with a demand that CNN, a foreign network, should be given preferential access to cover the funeral, possibly upstaging the South African Broadcasting Corporation, the national broadcaster. Already, all of this sounds more like showbiz than newsbiz in an industry that long ago watered down the serious content of its news. The South African soap opera surrounding Mandela's long goodbye plays in the trivialization of what should be a more solemn occasion. That's from Nelson Mandela's Final Battle, Dying with Dignity, by Danny Schechter, posted July 15th. Turkey, which trumpets its dedication to the Palestinian cause and its implacable opposition to Israel's occupation, can do the unthinkable and allow Israeli military forces to use its sovereign territory to attack an enemy. So much for the notion of Muslim solidarity, and so much for the Islamist criticism of Muslim states, Saudi Arabia, etc., that allow non-Muslim military forces, the U.S., etc., to attack fellow Muslim states, thereby betraying Islam. For Erdogan, the opportunity to bloody Assad's nose trumped all those considerations. The other problem with Turkey's decision is that it will give Israel the impression that since Turkey granted access to its military bases, it will also fold regarding its support of the Palestinians. That's from Israel used Turkish military base in Latakia attack. Unanswered Questions by Richard Silverstein, posted July 15th, originally appearing in Tikkun Olam. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. We are joined right now by Tom Burkhart. He is a San Francisco-based researcher and writer who writes for the website Anti-Fascist Calling and has been published in Covert Action Quarterly. He has for years been documenting the rise of police state powers and the erosions of citizen liberties under the weight of the corporate police state apparatus. And he's also a frequent contributor to the Global Research website. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay, so we've seen quite a lot of discussion about the the leaks coming through the Guardian's Glenn Greenwald and brought forward through NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. Was there anything about those disclosures that struck you as particularly revelatory or unique? Because I know that this is not the first time that it's come forward that the government has been trying to monitor people's conversations.
Well, I believe if we look at what Snowden has revealed, it confirms all previous information that's been disclosed by other whistleblowers, such as what Russell Tice, Thomas Drake, William Binney, and also from previous reporting that began really back in 1988 when Duncan Campbell, a British journalist, first exposed the Echelon system, which is basically the NSA's worldwide spying apparatus. So I think many of Snowden's revelations in terms of the documents he provided are really confirmation that the United States government has been engaged for decades in a massive global spying operation. And I think that's an important takeaway of what Snowden has revealed to The Guardian and also The Washington Post.
Now, you just mentioned Echelon right off the hop. I was wondering if you could maybe give us a bit of a breakdown, a kind of a domestic surveillance 101, if you will. This goes back, it has its origins in the end of World War II, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, the Echelon system has its origins at the end of World War II, but I think if we want to look at the United States surveillance apparatus, internally, it really goes back to the 1920s during and right after the First World War, when what became the FBI engaged in a series of raids that netted thousands of activists, socialists, anarchists. And this stretched on and included the Second World War and after the McCarthy Red Scares. We're also a constellation of private companies and government agencies spied on U.S. citizens. And we could track this through the 1960s with the COINTELPRO FBI operations that similarly, along with NSA and also CIA, targeted American activists and dissidents. So the Echelon system, per se, is really the NSA's global spy apparatus, and they, at the end of the Second World War, they signed an agreement with English-speaking countries, Canada, Britain, Australia, New Zealand, and they agreed to share what they described as signals intelligence. That's the mass of electronic communications that are carried by undersea cables and by satellites, and at the time also by microwave. So the Echelon system let me back up. Basically, what we're seeing now today is basically a continuation of the Echelon surveillance apparatus. I mean, it's pretty vast. It covers the entire globe and also in space.
Now, my understanding of Echelon was that essentially you have domestic countries that have laws against spying on your own citizens, but
right.
Through Echelon, you know, you can have Brits spy on Americans, you have New Zealanders spy on Canadians, and then this way they can just
exactly.
Pool everything together, and it ends up being a loophole around domestic laws, right?
It's a massive loophole. In fact, it's a hole so big that you can fly a jetliner through it. this is basically continuing today. What we're seeing is because of technological advances that have taken place over the decades, this has expanded exponentially. So with, you know, computing power and massive storage capacity of computers, you're now able to take everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there have been significant technological advances. You know, I remember there is that quote by Dwight Eisenhower, you know, beware the military-industrial complex. And, there is this whole idea that so much of technological development that, military needs was driving innovation. And, I mean, we're talking intelligence now. Are we seeing some sense in which intelligence and that need to surveil, is that a major driver of a lot of these technological innovations, like the way we've gone about it?
Well, I think one feeds off the other. Among some of the major revelations that have come out, especially since 2005, when the New York Times first published information about the current spying program under the Bush administration, what we've seen is the close collaboration between corporate America and the intelligence apparatus. I think that's the takeaway from what AT&T whistleblower Mark Klein exposed in 2006, that that company actually allowed the National Security Agency to tap into the Internet backbone by installing splitter equipment that was able to siphon off signals as they entered the United States and also as they transited the United States. It was William Binney, the NSA whistleblower, who said that AT&T and also Verizon and all the other major cellular companies have given access to the intelligence agencies to split off a portion of the electronic stream. So basically, it isn't just that the government has done this on their own. They're doing it in concert with giant multinational U.S. technology corporations. I think we could see that most clearly in the so-called PRISM program, which has identified nine high-tech firms like Apple, Microsoft, Skype, etc., have also given what was described in The Guardian as direct access to their networks. So I think that's the takeaway. It's not just that the government is spying, but that they're doing so in league with giant corporations. Mm-hmm. So I think that's extremely important to understand.
Could you, you mentioned PRISM. There's another program called Tempora. Do you want to maybe elaborate a little bit about that one?
Well,
and what that does, essentially.
Tempora was a project of GCHQ, which is the British equivalent of the National Security Agency. And they're also directly tapping into underseas and fiber optic networks throughout Britain, which has incredible implications for communications across Europe. So the Tempora program is actually, according to what Greenwald has written in The Guardian, is actually larger than equivalent U.S. programs. Now, I'm not sure whether that's correct or not, but I think it's another aspect of what the NSA has done here in the United States, which is to directly tap into the Internet backbone. So I think that's what Tempora is.
Mm-hmm.
It's another program that will collect everything and anything that they're able to get their hands on.
As we've seen more innovation, I guess the point I was trying to allude to with the whole sort of intelligence industrial complex situation is the way we develop technology. I mean, we have proprietary software, Microsoft, and you own the,
right,
the software, and so there you can have you are able to control much of the people who use that software. Unbeknownst to them, can find themselves a lot of their information being contained, controlled. And, I tend to wonder if things had developed differently, where you would be using things like GNU or Linux or free software, where you don't have that component, if the way we would have, the kind of technological,
right,
innovation would have happened differently.
Well, I mean, I think it would have happened differently, but the point is, most people can't write their own software programs. So they become reliant on these giant corporations to do so for them. So I'm not sure that, whether or not we use free programs or not, that mm-hmm. we're able to encrypt it sufficiently so that it's not able to be stolen, basically, by the government. And I think that's one interesting revelation that's come out is that Microsoft was actually handing over to the government data that was being generated by their customers before it was encrypted in Outlook and Hotmail, etc.
How far does this go? I mean, are we seeing elements of artificial intelligence starting to enter into the mix? I mean, what is the potential of this technology, given all of that whole sphere of technological developments and what's on the horizon? Do you have a good grasp on that?
I'm not sure so much about artificial intelligence, but I do know from what I've read, it's not that there's an individual sitting down somewhere you know, looking at all this data as it streams in, but it's being broken down by computer algorithms and stored. So let's say, for example, there's a data stream coming in from Canada. Well, it's not practical for, you know, analysts to look at each individual data packet as it comes in, but they are being broken down and stored in these giant computers, not only at places like Bluffdale in Utah or in Georgia at another NSA collection site. So I'm not sure where this is going to go in terms of artificial intelligence, to try and answer your question. I mean, I just don't know.
Okay. Well, let's looking at it at the political level. We hear the President Obama talking about how, well, it's not just we're not actually listening to people's telephone calls. I mean, we're looking at the metadata, who you've been talking with, and though that's sort of a package. But again, the understanding is, as I get it, is that you can really tell a lot just from that metadata, I guess maybe in a sort of a Sherlock Holmesian way. Is that something you could elaborate on?
I think it's important to understand that metadata isn't just simply, the to and from line in your email. It also can reveal, what networks exist. It could provide information about where you are. So there you have geolocational data. It could reveal what your networks are, who you're talking to, who they're talking to. So it goes out exponentially.
Yeah.
So metadata is, in many respects, it's actually more important than the content of your communication, because it could reveal who your friends are, who their friends are, etc. And I'm sure that when government agencies have spied on, let's say, the anti-war activists or Occupy Wall Street or other groups, who are engaged in political activity, the metadata is very important, because it can provide in broad outline exactly who's talking to who's connected to who. So it becomes very important in terms of, what can be brought against people by, government agencies and police agencies. And, this metadata is not just used by by agencies such as NSA or the FBI, but it's also being used by local law enforcement. There were several cases that became known last year where, drivers who were being stopped in California were having the contents of their cell phones downloaded by police, even if they weren't arrested. So this type of information should concern people generally, in terms of their privacy.
Mm. So, I think that, the people who seem to be defending the state in this instance, I mean, they're saying, well, you got to trade a little bit of privacy for security, but then you're not secure from the state apparatus who have concerns that are not restricted to what we conventionally think of as terrorism. But I guess what you described at the outset, the anti-war dissidents, labor organizers, and anyone who would be a threat to domestic power interests,
Exactly. And, this whole paradigm, that you have to trade a little privacy for a security is frankly a load of crap. I mean, there's no way, if you look at, if you go back to 9/11, or even more recently, the Boston Marathon bombing, these people were on the radar and they didn't do anything about it. I mean, they had this information. So how are we more secure by government agencies scooping up, terabytes, petabytes of information on each and every citizen, we're not any safer. In fact, it's just the opposite. Because they're training their lens on the population at large, in many instances, they're not even paying attention to, you know, people who may actually be bad actors, who may want to, you know, crazy people who may want to blow something up. Mm. So we're not any safer.
Another aspect of this, I remember, well, back in the 1950s and 60s, you had the CIA director collecting a lot of information on people, and you know, Nixon and so on, and the idea of using it to blackmail people. Is that a significant aspect of this as well? That politicians and so on could be vulnerable, including perhaps the president?
Well, I think as Russell Tice recently spoke about this to Sabelle Edmonds and also to James Corbett, he claims he actually had the orders in hand, that he actually had the tasking orders in hand to look at the communications of Samuel Alito before he became the Supreme Court Justice. And he also claims that he had in hand information about Obama. So I think, you know, going back to J. Edgar Hoover's so-called secret and confidential files on politicians, I think they're extremely vulnerable to blackmail.
So I guess we need to return to the idea of, just as citizens, how can we free ourselves from this, either acting individually or collectively? I mean, it's probably a little bit more complicated than pulling out of Facebook, right?
Well, it's a lot more complicated than that. It's actually... These aren't just technical questions. They're first and foremost political questions. And the political question is, who should have control of information that we have? Should it be the individual or should it be the government? And I don't think we could put any stock in politicians in Washington or anywhere else for that matter, because they're completely compromised in terms of what they're able to do or what they're even willing to do. I mean, they're beholden to giant corporations for campaign contributions, and I think it's really going to take a combined effort by citizens to take back their democracy. Hmm. And
is the will there, though?
What's that?
Is the will there to, I mean, given the pervasiveness of the technology, and there are certain pleasant spin-offs, but this is like the downside of it. And I'm wondering how, you know, given that it's...
Well, I mean, it's going to take people to stop being passive, you know, basically to get away from their computer screens and to actually take part in, you know, being citizens, to take responsibility for what goes on around them. You know, in the workplace, you know, amongst their friends, etc. It's not going to be an easy road. It's not going to be an easy road at all, considering, you know, the formidable technology that's out there, but it's not impossible.
Okay. Well, Tom Burkhart, thank you very much for sharing those insights with us, and also for your many posts. They're really quite compelling.
All right. Thank you, Michael.
And I've been speaking with Tom Burkhart, a San Francisco-based researcher and writer, who writes for the Anti-Fascist Calling website and has also submitted several posts to the Global Research website.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
To help put the Edward Snowden leaks in a Canadian context, We are joined on the line by Stephen Gowans. Stephen Gowans is an Ottawa-based writer and activist. His blog, What's Left, appears at www.gowans.wordpress.com. So, Steve, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Now, in your June article, Police States, Theirs and Ours, you spoke about how police state measures, or political policing, as you called it, is an intrinsic part of the state apparatus, whether we're talking communist countries or liberal democracies. And we usually think of liberal democracy and police states as two separate things. So I wonder if you could just sort of clarify that thought for us.
You're right. I mean, liberal democracies, people think of liberal democracies as antithetical to the idea of a police state. And even scholars who write on this have difficulty describing Canada, for example, a liberal democracy as a police state. And so they use phrases like political policing rather than a police state. At the same time, they acknowledge that, you know, the state in a liberal democracy like Canada has persistently spied on its own people, has run undercover agents and maintained secret sources of information and kept secret files that categorize people according to their political beliefs. And they point out that this political policing, as they call it, has been a persistent feature of Canadian political life from the country's birth to present. For example, and this we know that in 1977, an official inquiry discovered that the RCMP had files on 800,000 Canadians at a time when the country's population was about 23 million, so about 3% of the population had information about itself in some secret RCMP file. And, you know, you go right back to the beginning of the country. I mean, this political policing has involved listening in on conversations of citizens, which is something that, you know, we're concerned about now given the Snowden revelations, reading their mail, tracking their purchases, monitoring their personal relationships, enlisting human resources to spy on them. And also scholars who've studied this have pointed out that Canada is a country that's honeycombed with secret informers. When we talk about secret informers, usually think about Stasi informers. But in fact, there are secret informers in Canada as well. So when you put all these things together, you say, well, you know, maybe Canada might be considered a liberal democracy, but it certainly has behaved in a way that's consistent with what we think of as police states. And when you look at the way in which the Canadian state has behaved, it's really no different from the way in which other states have behaved that are not liberal democratic, like, say, the Cuban state or the East German state or the Soviet state. And in all cases, the state security services, whether you want to call them security services, as we tend to do when we're talking about liberal democracies, or police, secret police, as we tend to do when we're talking about those enemy states, in all cases, these intelligence services or security services are concerned with monitoring the activities and trying to disrupt the activities of those who pose a serious threat to the established political and economic order. So in a liberal democracy, the established political and economic order, of course, is capitalism. And the Canadian secret police have certainly, from its inception, been concerned about monitoring the activities of Canadian socialist radicals, in particular communists. At one time, communism has always been identified by the Canadian police state as the primary enemy of Canadian national security, or it was anyway until the collapse of the Soviet Union. No communist or suspected communist was too small or too inconsequential to be left alone by the security services. And the RCMP, for example, routinely enlisted postal employees to open the mail of people who belonged to the Communist Party. If you look then, say, at the activities of the security police in, say, East Germany, the East German security police were concerned about monitoring and disrupting the activities of those who posed a serious challenge to the established political and economic order in East Germany, which happened not to be communist, but those who wanted to say, restore capitalism within East Germany. Or also in East Germany being a special case, the Stasi often monitored people who wanted to migrate to the West because the East Germans had a big problem with this. They're trying to stanch the exodus of skilled workers from their country into West Germany.
In your article, just getting back to electronic surveillance, you mentioned the Communications Security Establishment Canada, CSEC, and it's essentially the Canadian counterpart of the NSA, and the electronic monitoring that was conducted post 9/11. Could you describe that program and how it compares with the comprehensive monitoring described by Edward Snowden in the U.S. and U.K.?
Yeah, I mean, so the NSA is getting all of the attention now because Snowden's documents pertain to the NSA. But and some people have pointed out that much of what Snowden has revealed was known previously. But the Canadian security establishment, being the Canadian equivalent of the NSA, as you pointed out, has been scooping up billions of bits of information transmitted around the world in cyberspace or in the airwaves. And this is something that has been reported in the newspapers in the last few years. So just like the NSA, the Canadian equivalent has been kind of hoovering up all of this big data that's available. Now, Canada, along with the U.S., Britain, Australia, and New Zealand are part of this kind of signals intelligence community called the Five Eyes, which spies on everything, but it spies also on other partners' citizens and then shares the data with them to circumvent laws prohibiting domestic spying. So the NSA could provide data it has on Canadians to the Canadian security establishment, which in turn could provide data it has on U.S. citizens to the United States. And in that way, they, you know, circumvent laws which say, well, you cannot spy on our own citizens. The Canadian security or security establishment also collects metadata, which Snowden and others have been talking about. So information on the date, duration, location, and recipient, say, of phone calls, of emails, text messages transmitted in Canada. And that, too, has been in the newspapers in the last few years. I guess it's just for whatever reason it hasn't aroused a lot of interest. So, you know, I mentioned earlier that by 1977, the RCMP had files on 800,000 Canadian citizens. But as a result of, you know, these advances in technology, the security establishment, the secret police, can now collect far more or much more data than they could at one point. So the Canadian police state now has the raw material to assemble files on the vast majority of Canadians.
Mm. It's kind of a shocking development when you consider the capabilities. I'm kind of curious to inspect, you know, any differences between the Canadian and U.S. Police state surveillance apparatus. Are there any differences in terms of whether it's legal protection or privacy laws or legislation or anything else that would maybe one country has better laws than the other, even if it's only in theory?
About that, I'm not entirely certain. You know, and that becomes kind of a confusing area. There's certainly understanding of certain laws, which seem to suggest that there's certain prohibitions on, you know, the kinds of information that can be collected. But there's other information that suggests that those prohibitions may simply exist in name alone and are circumvented readily and routinely.
Mm. Now, we sometimes hear, or we often hear about Canada being forced to toe the U.S. line, whether it's on trade or foreign affairs or military policy or what have you. In your view, has the Canadian police state developed independently of the U.S. police state, just as a reflection of that reality of the architecture of the state? Or is Canada in some way just being forced to go along with what the U.S. wants?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I would certainly say that the Canadian police state is certainly integrated with the U.S. police state, and Canada, as I mentioned, is certainly integrated with the U.S., British, Australian, and New Zealand intelligence communities because they all share information. And the forces, I think, which impinged upon the Canadian police state and shaped it in a certain direction are largely the same as those that impinged upon the U.S. police state. Whether Canada's compelled to go along, I guess you could ask, if Canada wanted to chart a different course, would it be able to? And I suspect it wouldn't. But, you know, whether there's this compulsion that's being exercised over Canada, I doubt there has to be.
Now, I think you just sort of... there's a bit of a segue there, because we often hear about how corporate forces are conspiring to push toward a North American union. And I'm wondering if that kind of harmonization introduces an architecture that by necessity will force the evolving police states in both countries into a cross-border harmonization there. Do you see indications in that direction?
Well, I think that they are largely harmonized right now. I mean, there's still some kind of like nominal independence, but Canada, I think, the Canadian security agencies may have kind of like a de facto subordinate relationship with the U.S. Certainly the United States would take the lead. Whether there be an increasing integration, I'm not sure. But I would say that they're already tightly integrated. You know, something that I should mention, because I was talking earlier about how the police state is often focused on radical socialists. And it makes it seem as if, and also how it tries to disrupt the activities of those that it considers to be a serious threat to the state. But I should also point out that the number of people that the Canadian police state has monitored is always larger than the number that actually poses a serious threat to the established political and social order. So, for example, I mean, the really conspicuous and interesting case of police state monitoring, or Canadian police state monitoring, is the case of Tommy Douglas, the leader of the New Democratic Party, who's credited with founding Canada's state-run health insurance program. Now, it's known that the RCMP, or the Canadian police state, had a file on Tommy Douglas and had one that is quite large, and they'd been monitoring his activities through essentially his entire career. And the Canadian, so that's interesting that they would have a file on Tommy Douglas. But the Canadian police state insists or refuses to release the file, even though Douglas has been dead for many, many years. And they refuse to release the file because they say if they did so, they would reveal the names of informants, some of whom may still be alive, while deterring others from working with the political police for fear their names may come to light in the future as informants. And it's interesting that there's a concern about informants, and also, as I mentioned earlier, there are scholars who study the secret policing in Canada who point out that Canada is really honeycombed with informers, and that the Canadian police state wouldn't be able to do what it does without the assistance of hundreds, if not thousands, or tens of thousands of informers.
Yeah, that's even without the whole electronic surveillance aspect of it.
And that's what struck me about the electronic surveillance. I mean, there was a great hue and cry and concern about the Snowden revelations, but, you know, it's not as if spying on or monitoring the behavior of citizens is anything new. This is simply an increase in the scope, but there's nothing new here at all.
Well, in that instance, what would you say Canadians could do to liberate themselves from such a police state? I mean, is this something that could be done independently of similar struggles say, in the U.S. and the U.K., or is it like, do we all have to work in concert?
I think as long as there are states, you can never liberate yourself from them, because as long as all states are by definition police states, all states have a police that is concerned with monitoring the activities of those who are going to threaten the established order. And whether that's a socialist country or some kind of autocracy or a liberal democracy. So the only way to liberate it yourself from that would be to live in the society that didn't have this kind of repressive state apparatus. And I'm not sure when that's going to happen. It's interesting, though, to ask about who is it that becomes agitated about police states and political policing. I mean, obviously, in Canada or the United States or Britain, those with conservative political views or those who are apolitical don't really care. And why would they care? Because they're not monitored, or they may be monitored. I doubt they're monitored. They're not monitored. They're not harassed. No one really cares, or the security state doesn't really care what they say or do. There are other people who are legitimately serious threats to the established political and economic order, and they're generally savvy about what's going on. So they know that their activities could be monitored, and they take steps to ensure that their activities aren't monitored. And then there's this kind of this group in between that's kind of agitated about what they've discovered. And I think that group perhaps is discovering that what they believed about liberal democracies, or they believed all the rhetoric about liberal democracies, and now are discovering that the rhetoric is just that, empty rhetoric. So, for example, you see in Germany, for example, some discomfort on the part of the chancellor, Angela Merkel, who's had to defend the fact that the German state is cooperating with the National Security Agency and spying on German citizens. So she says, well, you know, she's had to acknowledge that, in fact, this is happening. But her defense of it is, but, you know, it doesn't really matter because what we're doing is for good. It's, you know, those other states that that spy for bad reasons. But when liberal democracies spy on citizens, they do it for all the right reasons. But the reasons they're doing it in liberal democracies are exactly the reasons why, say, the Stasi in East Germany spied on people to defend. It's always a conservative function to defend the established order.
Okay. Well, Steve Gowans, I really appreciate those insights. Thanks for sharing them with us.
Thank you.
And we've been speaking with Steve Gowans, Ottawa-based writer and activist. You can check out his blog at www.gowans.wordpress.com.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across the country. We're also podcast at globalresearch.ca. You can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm.
Joining us now to discuss the media aspects of the Edward Snowden revelations is Julie Levesque. She is the associate editor at Global Research, as well as an independent journalist. So thanks for joining us, Julie.
Thanks for inviting me.
Okay, so I think, like myself, you were probably a little bit suspicious when you see so much mainstream media attention to the Snowden case. I guess my instinct is, well, what are they not telling us here? Especially when you consider that there are, like, these, you know, major internet companies that are being implicated, and like a lot of these entities are themselves sponsors of the corporate media. So I'm wondering what your feelings are about the way the mainstream media is covering the whole story around the NSA leaks. Is there anything diversionary about the way the mainstream media is covering the Snowden story?
What amazed me at the beginning was, like you said, you know, how much mainstream media attention Edward Snowden got. When Actually, there were a lot of other whistleblowers before him, and everyone who's been following the issue of spying did not learn much with Edward Snowden's revelations and leaks. Most people who, like Tom Burkhardt, for example, who's been writing on the issue for a long time, I don't think he learned much about Snowden's revelations. I think what he did was bring... proof.
Yes, confirmation of what Global Research and others have been publishing for a while.
But those two articles I wanted to tell your listeners about is there's one from Steve Kenny. It came out just a few days, I think, after the story broke out, and it's called NSA Deception Operation: Questions Surround Leaked PRISM Documents Authenticity. So it says it in the title, you know, he questions the authenticity of the documents. And he asks whether Snowden was spotted before he decided to leak the documents and whether he was set up by the NSA. And it's a very interesting article. And actually, he doesn't say that Snowden is part of the deception operation, but rather that he's used by the NSA. Because, you know, he said
he's an asset, in other words.
Yeah. He said he was talking about it with his colleagues, you know, the fact that there were things that the NSA was doing that he was not, that he didn't necessarily approve. So he thinks that he might have been spotted and set up by the NSA. And he points to another PRISM program, which is very interesting. It's another program called PRISM, but it's by the DHS. And he says it's very unlikely that two different programs from two major government agencies like that would have the same name. So, and he jokes about it, saying, you know, only Monty Python's calls everyone Bruce to avoid confusion. so it's a very interesting article.
Well, fascinating.
Yes, and the other one is from Naomi Wolf. The title is My Creeping Concern That the NSA Leaker Edward Snowden Is Not Who He Purports to Be. And what she says is that, you know, she's been following other whistleblowers like Julian Assange, you know, and she says that Snowden is very organized. And what she sees in his interview with Greenwald, because at the time that's all that he had done, you know, the first interview with Greenwald, and she says that she sees evidence of great media training, you know, the fact that he insisted on publishing a PowerPoint, that he arranged to have a talented filmmaker to shoot the interview, how much emphasis he puts on his own self-sacrifice. Those are things that make her wonder, you know.
It's not part of the job description of somebody who would normally contract as a technical contractor with the NSA.
Yeah. She says that what he does is actually in the interest of the police state, you know, because it's in the interest of the police states to let you know that everything about everything you could lose, you know, if you stand up against it. You know, the fact that he says, oh, I'm going to lose my job, I'm not going to be able to return home, I'm losing, you know, my family, contact with my family and everything. And she says, you know, it's in the interest of the police state that you know that if you stand up to it, this is what's going to happen to you, you know. It's in their interest so that everyone... know that they know everything you write, that you're being surveilled, and that, you know, awful things can happen to people who challenge this.
Mm.
So it's a very interesting article. But then again, I think from what I've seen, they're the only two who have been, you know, questioning Snowden and the actual leak, you know.
Now, there's this an article that seems to be going viral right now on the mysterious death of journalist Michael Hastings. Is that something you want to address?
You know, Michael Hastings was known as a muckraker. You know, he was a guy who was very aggressive in his way of doing journalism.
He brought down General Stanley McChrystal, as I understand it.
Yeah. He's the one who wrote Runaway General, which led to his dismissal. The day before he died, he wrote an email to the people he worked with at BuzzFeed, and he copied... he CC'd a sergeant that he met in Afghanistan, He was embedded in his unit at the time. And he sent an email at 1 p.m. On Monday, June 17th. And at 4:20 a.m. the following morning, he died in a car crash. And the subject of his email was FBI investigation. And what I'll read it to you. It says, "The feds are interviewing my close friends and associates. Perhaps if the authorities arrive at BuzzFeed, it would be wise to immediately request legal counsel." And he said, "I'm on to a big story, and I need to go off the radar for a bit." And, you know, not even 12 hours later, a little bit more than 12 hours later, he was dead.
He was, his car exploded, like this big fireball, and so much damage was done that they needed to check his dental records to identify him.
Yeah, and there was a really good article. The article that you were talking about, which went viral this morning, was published by Who, What, Why. It's called, on Global Research, we called it Death of Rolling Stone Muckraker, The Michael Hastings Wreck, Video Evidence Only Deepens the Mystery. And it's a very good article. It says that in the area where the accident happened, it's very rare that there are car accidents there. They said there were no skid marks, no apparent attempt for to brake before the collision. And one of a U.S. Navy military policeman told one of the reporters that he said, "I've seen military vehicles explode before, but not like that." And he said, "Look, here's a reporter who brought down a general, and he's sending out emails saying he's being watched by the FBI. It's 4 a.m. and his car explodes." He said, "Come on, you have to be naive not to at least consider that this was not an accident."
Hmm.
So this is just a little quote from the article. It's a pretty long article, but it's really I think really important.
And it goes along with that whole idea that that we're talking about. You know, the state protecting domestic power interests, and if you have genuine journalists like Hastings who are challenging power,
yes.
Well, you know, they're effectively enemies as well.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And today, I think it was today, no, a few days ago, there was another article which was published about, you know, spying on journalists, and it's the Department of Justice, which is setting new guidelines concerning government surveillance of members of the press. Interestingly enough,
mm-hmm.
And they say that this will help ensure the proper balance when pursuing investigations into unauthorized disclosures. So this has everything to do, again, with Snowden's revelations as well. And in his article, Tom Carter says that this was published in the New York Times, and he says... The New York Times says that the reform would significantly narrow the circumstances under which journalist records could be obtained, but he says the memorandum actually does nothing of the kind, that it's not that at all. So.
Well, Julie Levesque, it's been great talking to you. Thanks for sharing those articles with us. And
thank you.
So Julie Levesque, she's the associate editor of Global Research and also an independent journalist.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.